All right, we're going to continue the survey of the circulatory system now by going to its subset, the cardiovascular system. Remember, those aren't interchangeable terms. Cardiovascular system, not a true organ system, not a complete organ system. It's just the heart and vessels. We already finished blood, though, and this chapter is devoted just the heart, so only part of the cardiovascular system. The heart, of course, is the pump in the circulatory system. So there is forced convection in human circulation. I've talked about convection before. It's the bulk movement of a fluid. You wouldn't have to have a heart to have circulation of fluids or movement of fluids, but it's a lot more efficient if you do have a dedicated heart. Otherwise, you'd have to rely on other forces to move things around. The heart, though, provides the force that drives the convection of the blood. And the blood courses through a closed system of vessels. Not all animals are like this. Some have an open circulatory system. Ours is closed. Now, it's not entirely sealed, of course. It couldn't be, because things have to get into and out of the bloodstream for it to do its job. So it is leaky here and there, especially at the capillaries, but it's still a closed system of tubes, and those tubes are arranged in a circuit, which is why the blood keeps going around and around. But we can really think about two different circuits, or at least they're named different circuits. The heart is not only a pump, it's really a dual pump. So the two sides, right and left, are each pumping through its own circuit, pumping blood through its own circuit. And those two circuits, as we see here, are called the pulmonary circuit and the systemic circuit. Now, pulmonary means of the lungs, right? So, which part of the heart is involved in serving or pumping blood to the pulmonary circuit? Anyone know? Well, that's not part of the heart, actually. I mean, it starts at the heart. But, I mean, which half of the heart? The right. The right side... of the heart receives blood from the systemic circuit on its way back, but it then sends that blood or pumps that blood toward the lungs. And therefore, blood leaving the heart and first entering the pulmonary circuit is largely deoxygenated blood, because this is blood that has just previously returned from the rest of the body. The oxygen was delivered to those tissues. Carbon dioxide was picked up from those tissues. So blood in the pulmonary circuit, at least between the heart and the lungs, the first part of the pulmonary circuit, is not only deoxygenated, it's also enriched in carbon dioxide. Now, this is why it's not correct to learn vessels by saying that veins carry deoxygenated blood and arteries carry oxygenated blood. That's true only for most of the cases. There are exceptions, right? Which is why you shouldn't learn it that way. There are no exceptions, though, to the following. All arteries carry blood away from the heart, regardless of oxygenation status. And all veins carry blood back to the heart. All right? So that's what the job of the right half of the heart is, to receive the blood that's coming back from the rest of the body, which is deficient in oxygen and loaded with carbon dioxide. That needs to be sent to the lungs for that gas exchange to take place there. So the pulmonary, the middle, in a sense, of the pulmonary circuit is the capillary bed, all the group of all the capillaries that surround the alveoli in the lungs. That's where the gas exchange takes place. As you ventilate, or breathe in and out, you're bringing in oxygen from the air. Well, you're bringing in air, which includes oxygen, so that that oxygen is going to diffuse through the membranes of the lung and the capillary wall and go into the blood. At the same time, carbon dioxide is going to diffuse in the opposite direction. So it's diffusion that causes gas exchange at these capillary beds. All right. As that happens, now the blood in the second half of the pulmonary circuit is oxygen rich because you just got it from the lungs. And you've dumped off that carbon dioxide to exhale. So it's fresh blood now coming back to the heart, but it's still part of the pulmonary circuit because it's coming from the lungs. That fresh blood coming back from the lungs is then delivered to the left side of the heart, the other pump. So it's two pumps in one. And so the left side of the heart, after receiving this freshly oxygenated blood from the lungs, is going to then pump it to all the other parts of the body besides the lungs. That's what makes up the systemic circuit. And so blood just leaving the left side of the heart is still oxygenated. As it gets delivered to the tissues, it becomes more and more deoxygenated because those tissues, because of diffusion at their own capillaries, they're going to take oxygen away from the blood. So you have a capillary bed in the pulmonary circuit that's surrounding the lung tissue. You can think of it as one big capillary blood bed, like you see here in this diagram for the systemic circuit, but really it's just all of the capillary beds around all of the other tissues besides the lungs. Okay? That blood will be collected into bigger and bigger veins on its way back to the heart until it's dumped into the right half for another trip around both circuits. Okay, to two now. Main point of this slide is to show you the position of the heart within the thoracic cavity. First of all, it's in the thorax, right? It's not in the abdomen. But more specifically, it's in a section within the thorax. The heart itself is really not perfectly centered. It's a little bit off-center to the left. By the way, when you use right and left, always remember that those apply to the person owning the organ or structure you're examining. It's not your right or left, it's that person's right or left. The easiest way of thinking about it is just to imagine being the person. Put your body in that position and then use your own right or left. But when you look at a person from the front, its right is on your left. So anyway, the heart is a little bit left of center, but it's centrally located, meaning it's between the two lungs. The fact that it's not perfectly centered, by the way, is why the left lung is a little smaller than the right lung. The heart takes up a little bit of room. But the heart is not the only thing you find in between the lungs. The lungs take up the majority of the volume of the thorax. But running between them, or located between them, is not only the heart, but a bunch of tubes as well, including not only the major vessels that come from or go to the heart directly, but also you have the trachea leading to the lungs, and you have the esophagus leading to the stomach. You have the thymus in there as well that we talked about. All of that stuff that's in the midline between the two lungs takes up a subdivision of the thorax that we give a special name. Anyone know that name? Right, that's the mediastinum. And so the heart is just one of the various things that reside in the mediastinum. but it's situated just a little bit left of center. It's also, well, the overall heart has what's called the base and the apex. An apex is a point. The heart is pointed at one end a little bit. The base is the opposite end. The base is where the major plumbing is attached. The biggest arteries and the biggest veins attached to the heart at the base. And so the heart is also a little bit tilted. The base isn't horizontal. The apex is not right at the bottom. It's a little bit angled toward the left, as you see here in the mediastinum. Now to three. Do you remember talking about serous membranes in 201? So you have the memory, but that's where it ends. Serous membranes, well, what does the word serous mean? Serous is the adjective form of serum, but serum is a more, you know, usually serum that we talked about in the blood, that's just an example of a serum. It's not the only serum. Serum is kind of a general word, meaning a pretty watery fluid, not very viscous, which is what plasma gets when you take out the fibrinogen, like we talked about. It's more watery than plasma, so it's called blood serum. And serous membranes get their name for the fact that there is a serous fluid, a watery fluid, in between two layers of membrane. So there are various serous membranes in the body, like the peritoneum is the serous membrane in the abdomen. There are also serous membranes around the lungs. That's called the pleura. And the heart has its own dedicated serous membrane called the pericardium, okay, or pericardial sac. Now, any given, well, first of all, the reason that serous membranes exist is for lubrication. So any given serous membrane is double layered with a space, not very big space, but a space between the two layers that contains serous fluid for whatever specific serous membrane you're talking about. There's two layers of membrane sandwiching serous fluid between it. In the case of the heart, those two layers, the specific serous fluid that's sandwiched between the two layers is called pericardial fluid. But you also have peritoneal fluid in the abdomen between its two layers, and pleural fluid between the two layers that surround the lung. But in all three of those cases, the serous membranes exist so that things can move around with respect to each other without rubbing the hell out of each other. And that's why this cartoon of this fist punching into a water balloon is a good analogy. If you put your fist into your hand, your other hand, and you move your fist around, you're going to rub these two structures on each other, right? And if you did that for your whole lifetime, it would be very sore. You would wear it out. But imagine taking a balloon that's filled with water, and not very tightly, so it's loosely, still has a lot of stretch in it. And if you put your fist into that balloon, first of all, notice that's going to cause two layers. There's going to be a layer of latex, the rubber the balloon's made out of, that's right on the surface of your fist. And there's also going to be the outer layer with water in between those two layers. That's what a serous membrane is like. And if you imagine doing that, then you would be able to move your fist with respect to your other hand without rubbing them, because that serous fluid would lubricate that action. And so your heart is able to beat for a lifetime, exactly for a lifetime, actually. Unless you get a transplant. Without rubbing itself to death or other surrounding structures because of the pericardium. Now, I said that every serous membrane has two layers. Of course, it's really one layer that wraps around back on itself. But the two layers get separate names. And so there is, in any given serous membrane, a parietal layer. And what did I say in 201 parietal means? Or what did we? When did we use that word in 201? The parietal lobe of the brain, and it's named for what? Its proximity to what? What else is parietal? The parietal bones of the skull, right? Which are these side bones? Well, parietal means of a wall, forming a wall. So, in any given serous membrane, the more superficial of the two layers is called the parietal layer. And the deeper layer, which is the layer that is in direct contact with whatever structure is being surrounded by that serous membrane, in this case the heart, that's called the visceral layer. Visceral meaning deep guts, right? So that's what you have labeled here. The pericardial sac, which is the overall serous membrane, has a fibrous layer and a serous layer. The fibrous layer is really just another name for the parietal layer of that serous membrane. And in between those layers, you have pericardial fluid. All right, that's the only thing I really want to mention about that slide. The rest of these terms will be used later. Let's go on to four. On top, we're looking at the external anatomy as viewed anteriorly, which is why the left ventricle is on your right, as I said before. The left ventricle is the ventricle that serves the systemic circuit, so it by far is the strongest of the four chambers. But we should mention that the heart overall is made up of four chambers. All right, so there are two types of chambers in the heart. Atria, which is the plural of atrium, and ventricles. Now, architecturally, what does atrium mean? It's a word from architecture. An atrium is an entryway, but even more specifically, a true atrium is an entryway with an open roof. And this describes the top or the base end of the heart. It's an entryway because that's where blood gets dumped into the heart on both sides. Veins dump blood into the two atria, which are entryways into the heart. And they're open roofed because they have holes in them allowing these veins to dump the blood. That's why they get their names. All four chambers are muscular walled chambers. But the atria don't have to be nearly as muscular as the ventricles. And that's because the only distance they have to push the blood through is just from the atrium downstairs to the ventricle. So there's not very much resistance to that flow. It's easy to push blood, especially downward, because gravity itself helps. So the atrial walls, the muscle making up the atrial walls, I should say, is much thinner. And the atria themselves are smaller chambers. The ventricular walls, on the other hand, have to be much more muscular because they have to push that blood through long lengths of vessels. But the pulmonary circuit isn't nearly as much doesn't have nearly as much resistance to flow because it's a shorter circuit to go to the lung and back, lungs and back, than the systemic circuit, which is all the rest of the body. And that's why the left ventricle, which is the ventricle that pumps blood into the systemic circuit, is far thicker walled than the right ventricle is. It's a much stronger muscle. Well, those are the chambers. And if we look at the surface anatomy on the top, this is as it's situated in the body. So this is the apex down here. And notice the left ventricle and the right ventricle are labeled here, which are the majority of the exterior surface because the atria are so much smaller. But right between those two ventricles, you have what is labeled an interventricular sulcus. Well, it's labeled in the, where it shows the fat. There's a fat that collects in that interventricular sulcus. But the interventricular sulcus, of course, is a sulcus. And what does that word mean? Yeah, it's a groove, right? Where did we talk about sulci, which is the plural of sulcus, in 201? The cerebral cortex has gyri and sulci, right, as major features. The gyri are the hills, the sulci are the valleys. So it's a groove on the surface of the heart between the two ventricles, and therefore it's called interventricular sulcus. And it's not just fat that's in there, it's also where some major blood vessels serving just the heart itself are located. So you have the anterior interventricular artery there, for instance. There's a posterior sulcus as well, so there's going to be this kind of the same thing on the back. When we talked about the two circuits, pulmonary and systemic, you can actually add a third circuit to that called the coronary circuit. Coronary means of the heart, right? Or cardiac is another word that's used. The heart itself, even though the heart is full of blood, that blood is not really the blood that feeds the heart or that serves the heart. The walls of the ventricles especially, but the walls of the heart in general, are too thick for diffusion to get oxygen far enough and to pick up carbon dioxide. Like I've talked about before, when you're a large animal, that's why you need convection, right? To get blood close enough to each cell so that diffusion can take over. So the thickness of the heart can't be served by the blood that's in the ventricles. It's too far away for diffusion. And therefore, the heart actually has its own subdivision of veins and arteries. Arteries bringing blood to the heart itself, from the heart to the heart muscle thickness, and then back to the heart itself. That's its own little circuit, really, the coronary circuit. And this anterior interventricular artery is just part of that circuit, is what I'm trying to say. All right, when you look at the thing in cross-section, and what kind of section is this, actually? I shouldn't say cross-section, it's a section. What kind of section is this? This is a coronal or a frontal section, right. So you're looking at the back half of it. The front half has been removed. Anyway, this gives you an appreciation of what I told you about thickness of the walls. Very thick muscle. It's actually not as much space as you might have imagined by looking at the outside of the heart. It's not all that hollow. It's made up of a lot of muscle. But muscle isn't the only kind of tissue. Actually, you have all four kinds of tissue in the heart because it's innervated, so there's nervous tissue. It's lined by epithelium, so there's epithelial tissue, both outside and inside. But you also have connective tissue, which forms what's called the fibrous skeleton, and that includes the valves that we'll talk about later and other connective tissue. And then the rest of it, which is the bulk of it by mass, is muscle tissue. Well, that muscle tissue is made up of specifically cardiac muscle cells, right, of the three types of muscle there are. Of course, it's cardiac muscle that the heart is made up of, not smooth or skeletal. That's one of three layers when you look at the histology of the of a wall of the heart. There are three layers that make up the wall. And the muscle layer, which is by far most of that thickness, is the middle of those three layers. The muscle is called the myocardium. What does myo mean? Muscle. Right, so myocardium literally means heart muscle. That's the majority of this thickness. There is an mostly epithelial, it's partly epithelial, partly connective tissue layer, though, that is superficial, so the outside of the heart, and that's called the epicardium, epi meaning over, just like epidermis is over the dermis in the skin. Well, the epicardium is really just another name for the visceral pericardium. All right, so remember the visceral layer of any serous membrane is the part that's in direct contact with the thing being surrounded. Well, the thing being surrounded is the heart. That myocardial layer is in direct contact with that visceral peritoneum. So we use the phrase visceral peritoneum if we're describing pericardium. We use that word if we are caring about talking about the pericardium itself as an isolated structure. But if we talk about layers of the heart, then we use for exactly the same layer, we use the word epicardium. But that epicardium is that inner layer or that deeper layer, visceral layer of the pericardium. Okay, that's two layers. The inner layer, the deeper layer, deepest, is the endocardium, which is also epithelial tissue and a little bit of connective tissue, just like the epicardium, only the epicardium also has some fat associated with it. There's no fat on the endocardium. So the endocardium is mostly epithelial, like I say, and therefore smooth. And that endocardium also covers the valves, which we haven't talked about yet. And after wrapping around the valves throughout all the chambers, and this isn't just the ventricles, it's ventricles and atria have endocardium to them. After coating the interior surfaces of all the heart structures, the endocardium is continuous with the endothelium of the blood vessels. All right. So the cells that make up the inner lining of the blood vessels are continuous with this layer of cells known as, in the heart, known as endocardium. Those are the three layers. The two ventricles are separated by a pretty wide wall called the septum. Now a septum is a general word that means something that separates, like the nasal septum separates the two halves of the nose. But this separates the two ventricles, and therefore it's called the interventricular septum. Notice these papillary muscles that you find in the ventricles. Papillary means finger-like. A papilla is a finger-like projection, so papillary is just the adjective of that. These papillary muscles are little bundles of muscle coming off of the inner surface of the ventricle. But notice where they come to their finger-like tip. That's an anchoring point for connective tissue strands called either cordae tendineae, that's the Latin form, or tendinous cords. You can call them either one. So these tendinous cords are anchored at one end to the papillary muscles. At the other end of the tendinous cord, it's anchored to a flap of a valve. specifically a type of valve called an atrioventricular valve, because it's a valve that is situated between the atrium above and the ventricle below. So that's the passageway blood has to take to be pumped from an atrium to the ventricle. It has to go through the atrioventricular valve. And it's called a valve for good reasons. Valves are one-way passageways, right? They allow passage in one direction but not the other. This is important because you want to keep blood flow unidirectional. Well, squeezing the atrium, which is what happens when it contracts, will squeeze blood through that atrioventricular valve into the ventricle. But then if the ventricle right thereafter contracts, if it weren't a valve but just a hole between the atrium and the ventricle, it would squeeze the blood right back up into the atrium because that has the least resistance, much less resistance to go up into the atrium than through these tubes into the rest of the body. The valves close when that happens, ensuring that the blood gets pushed forward into the circuit rather than back up into the atrium. Well, that's the purpose of these cordae tendini, or tendinous cords. The contraction of the ventricle forces the valve closed, but the force is so hard that it would actually force these valve cusps or flaps backwards so that it would open back up. The cords hold them in place and only allow them to close but not go any farther. And so you have those only on atrioventricular valves as opposed to the other kind of valves we're going to talk about. So the whitish ones are the tendinous cords. Let us go on to five. It's easier to see individual structures in the cartoon version, which is what we have here. So an anterior view in the front. I've already explained that the major vessels all connect to the heart at the base. So that's why there's a lot of stuff going on here at the base. We haven't talked about these vessels yet, but let's do that. Now, the vessels begin at the heart. Of course, after you leave the heart, you're strictly speaking no longer in the heart. Now we're talking about vessels, but it makes sense to talk about these major vessels that connect directly to the heart. And so if we think about the right atrium, first of all, it's an atrium, so it's receiving blood, right? And therefore, connecting to the right atrium, you should have what kind of vessels? Veins, because veins carry blood back to the heart. As far as circuits are concerned, blood is coming into the right atrium from where? No. Oh, no, not from the lungs. Which circuit? The systemic circuit. That's what the right atrium is receiving blood from, the systemic circuit. The rest of the body other than the lungs. Well, there are two major veins that dump blood into the right atrium from the systemic circuit. One from roughly the top half of the body, one from the lower half of the body. And those are called the superior and inferior veni cavi. That's the plural. One of them is a vena cava. Right, for the plural, you put an E on each word, veni cavi. But there's one superior vena cava that drains the upper part of the body, except for the lungs, and one inferior vena cava that drains the lower part of the body. They both come together kind of in the back as you look at the posterior view. Superior and vena cava come together right, they basically dump at the same place right into the right atrium. So these veins are carrying deoxygenated blood. All right. Now, veins are usually colored blue because deoxygenated blood has more of a bluish tinge. But veins are colored blue just by convention, even the veins that are carrying oxygenated blood. So just realize that. Anyway, that's the end of the systemic circuit. The superior and inferior vena cava, those are the end of the vascular part of the systemic circuit. The right atrium receives that blood. All right? The left atrium, on the other hand, is receiving blood from where? From the lungs. This time it's oxygenated blood, because it has just been oxygenated by the lungs. And once again, there are two major veins carrying this blood to this chamber, to this atrium as well, which makes sense because there are two lungs, right? And so these two veins are called pulmonary veins, veins from the lungs. But there's a right pulmonary vein and a left pulmonary vein. Okay? Those are dumping into the left atrium. So atria, as receiving chambers, have connected to them directly veins, which are part of the base of the heart. Now the ventricles are shipping centers, right? They are where the blood leaves the heart. So each ventricle pumps into its own vessel, but since this is blood that's leaving the heart in both of those cases, right and left, that vessel needs to be an artery, right? Needs to be called an artery. And it is. So the major artery that the right ventricle pumps into, since that blood is now part of the pulmonary circuit and going to the lungs, is called the pulmonary vein. Well, actually, specifically, the part that directly connects to the heart is called the pulmonary trunk. Now, trunk is a name for a pretty wide and pretty short tube. We call things trunks if they don't travel very far before they split. And that's exactly what's happening here at the pulmonary trunk. You have a splitting. This is the trunk itself. Actually, the front view shows you the better view of the trunk. The pulmonary trunk coming from the right ventricle only travels about that far before it breaks into or branches into the right and left pulmonary arteries. Now, I guess I was wrong about the always using blue for veins and red for arteries. They're showing you the pulmonary arteries as blue, which makes more sense, right? Because it's carrying deoxygenated blood. Anyway, it makes sense that there's a right and left pulmonary artery because they're going to go to separate lungs. The beginning of that is actually, the beginning of that pulmonary trunk is actually, you'd have to open up the heart to see where it starts because it's the bottom chamber, the right ventricle, that pumps into it. So we're looking at just the part after it emerges through the walls of the heart. Same thing is going on in the left side, but for a different circuit, of course. And so the left ventricle, the strongest of the chambers, the one that's serving the systemic circuit, pushes all of its blood through the aorta, which is just another word for artery. The aorta is the biggest artery in terms of diameter. And it's one that you don't want to damage. Now you can see that the aorta, as soon as it exits the heart, forms kind of a hairpin loop. And then, so it comes out in terms of blood flow, it's rising, then it curves, and then sent downward through the thorax, through the diaphragm, which is the boundary between the thorax and the abdomen, and into the abdomen. Along the way, though, it puts off branches to major structures. And you can see that there are branches right away, even while it's still called the aortic arch. The aortic arch, obviously, is just the part that arches. right after the aortic arch, when it straightens out and is descending, we that's the beginning of what's called the descending aorta. That first part of the descending aorta is the thoracic aorta, but here we're outside of the heart and getting more into the vessels, which we'll talk about later. But the aortic arch has three major branches to it that you see here. Even before you get to those branches, and we'll talk about those branches in a different chapter, even before you get to those branches, though not seen here, right exactly where the aorta emerges from the main part of the heart are two smaller branches, right and left version, which are coronary arteries. So the heart is taking a little bit of the blood that is going to be sent to the systemic circuit and saving it for itself to get to the depth, the thickness of the heart, serve those muscles. The coronary sulcus is another groove, and you see this groove around the base, but it's especially deep in the back of the heart. And so the sulcus is just the groove itself. Lying in that groove, though, is a vein called the coronary sinus. Now, it is a vein because it's carrying blood toward the heart. This happens to be blood that is collected from the heart itself. So it's part of the coronary circuit. Blood that's coming back from the heart tissue still needs to, since it's deoxygenated now, still needs to be dumped into the right atrium, like the systemic circuit does. But all of this coronary blood, heart blood, gets put into this vein. It is a vein, but since it's a pretty wide-spaced vein, it's called a sinus. Sinus means space. And that coronary sinus, which is in the coronary sulcus, delivers coronary deoxygenated blood to the right atrium, along with the systemic deoxygenated blood. Okay. By the way, auricle. You can see the left auricle labeled here, and there's a right auricle as well, even though it's not on this figure. What does that word mean? It ends in ickle, so it means small something. It means small ear. An auricle is an ear-shaped structure. In fact, the visible part of our ears is called the auricle. That's one of its names, or the pinna. Anyway, each of the two atria has a flap sticking off of it called an auricle. And it's just really kind of an outpocketing. It slightly enlarges the space within the atrium. But if it didn't exist, the heart would still work. Well, let's go to 6 then. In this view, which is not how you would actually see a heart, what's the outer layer of the heart wall? The epicardium. Normally, you would just, you know, if you removed the fibrous pericardium, which is the parietal part, you would still see the epicardium on the actual surface of the heart. That's been drawn as though it's clear, so you can see through it, basically. Of course, you wouldn't really normally be able to see through it. But the reason is so that you can see the grain of the myocardium, which is just deep to the epicardium. And that's the muscle, of course. Well, the grain of a muscle shows you the direction in which it contracts, right? Like the grain of a skeletal muscle, you can tell it's going to contract in that direction and therefore pull on a certain bone. Here, this isn't skeletal muscle, so it's not pulling on a bone. But notice that the grain is in a spiral pattern. And we call this arrangement the myocardial vortex. When you look at it from the view of the apex, which you're doing here, this is a bottom view, mostly, an apical view, you can see that it's a vortex or a spiral pattern. The reason that this is important functionally is because the ventricles operate by contracting in order to push blood from those ventricles into the major artery, either the aorta on the right, on the left side, or the pulmonary trunk on the right side. To do that, to operate efficiently as a pump, each cycle, which would mean each heartbeat, you want to eject as much blood as possible. You're not doing as efficient a job if you don't totally empty the ventricle. And so by having this myocardial vortex, this spiral arrangement, that means not only is the ventricle contracting, but it's contracting in such a way that's like wringing it out rather than just collapsing it. And it's, and the contraction, as we'll talk about later, kind of starts at the apex, the tip, which is the end of the chamber away from the vessel opening. And by wringing it down there first and then spreading that wringing upward, you push all that blood that you can out of the ventricle and into the either the aorta or the pulmonary trunk. So that explains the spiral arrangement. Now to seven. Here we get a much better view of the valves I've been talking about. And there are four heart valves, but they come in two varieties, two categories. I already mentioned atrioventricular valves. There's two of those because there are two atria and two ventricles. So each atrioventricular valve, as the name indicates, is situated between an atrium and the corresponding ventricle. There's one on the right and there's one on the left. So these go by different names. I mean, you have multiple names to choose from. They're all atrioventricular valves, or they're both atrioventricular valves. But you can call the one that's between the left atrium and the left ventricle the left atrioventricular valve. You can call the one that's between the right ventricle and the right atrium the right atrioventricular valve. But you can also call that right atrioventricular valve the mitral valve, M-I-T-R-A-L. Mitral is an adjective that means like a mitre, M-I-T-R-E. Anyone know what a mitre is? It's a bishop's hat. So the Pope has the most ridiculous of the hats, right? But slightly less ridiculous are the bishop hats, which are kind of shaped like this. The flaps that make up the mitral valve looked like that to someone who named it, so it's called the mitral valve. So these atrioventricular valves, since they're connecting the atrium to the ventricle, always open downward. As they open up, they need to allow blood to go from the atrium above to the ventricle below. So the flaps, which they're made up of, which are called cusps, move downward like shutters doors. All right? And like I was talking about earlier, they would be allowed to open backward if it weren't for the fact that these tendinous cords get stretched and prevent that from happening. All right? That's the main use of the papillary muscles, to anchor those tendinous cords. The other category of... Let me give you an alternative name for these things, the atrioventricular valves. One of them goes by the name tricuspid, one of them goes by the name bicuspid. Which is which, anyone know? The left atrioventricular valve is made up of two flaps, and so it's called the bicuspid valve. Whereas the mitral valve, or the right atrioventricular valve, is made up of three, and therefore an alternative name for that is the tricuspid valve. The other category of valves, though, is semilunar valves. And what does that literally mean? Half moon, right. The little flaps that make up the semilunar valves look like half moons in isolation. So these things are called semilunar valves. Now, there are two semilunar valves, just like there are two atrioventricular valves. But semilunar valves in general allow passage of blood from a ventricle into the major artery that that ventricle serves. So you have one on the left side and one on the right side that we'll mention more about next time, but I don't want Angel to start bitching about that.